Welcome back, Question Madison 2018. I'm Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It seems like just about a year ago, well, actually today, Irma was bearing down on Florida. My microphone was all packed up in my car. My computer was all stored away. And now, fast forward 1 year later, and we have another hurricane problem going on in the United States. What is going on? Maybe it is El Nino, maybe it is global warming, or maybe it is just not enough questioning medicine. Whatever the cause, I am back at it. So without further ado, without further hesitation, reservation, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back, 2018. I am Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, and let's get it started. I think we're going to jump into the very first article here right off the bat, and it is maybe the most useful article I'm going to talk about because it's something that we all give in every field of medicine, even dentists. Oh yes, I'm talking about antibiotics, and there is a paper titled Risk of Methicillin-Resistant Staphylococcus aureus and C. diff in Patients with Documented Penicillin Allergy, a Population-Based Matched Cohort Study. This is BMJ 2018. Now, we all know when a patient comes in, they say, hey, I'm allergic to penicillin, that usually if you dig down a little deeper into, are you really allergic to penicillin? It's probably not true. It's probably not really an allergy to penicillin, but we're all very busy. And to try to sit there and tease out, when did this happen? What was your actual reaction to it? It takes a lot of time that we may or may not have. So often, and I'm also guilty of it, you just put, okay, fine, allergic to penicillin, whatever, and you move on. Well, this population-based match cohort study from the United Kingdom looked at a huge amount of adults, over 300,000 adults, and then it looked at the primary outcome was your risk of having MRSA or C. diff. And what do you know, that if you had a quote-unquote penicillin allergy, you were at increased risk of MRSA and C. diff. In fact, an increased use of beta-lactam alternative antibiotics accounted for a 55% increase in the risk of MRSA and a 35% increase in the risk of C. diff. If you are blindly writing penicillin allergy just because you don't want to have the conversation, then an antibiotic or an infectious disease angel is certainly losing their wings. And to follow that paper up with one from Allergy 2017 titled Clinical Outcomes Following Inpatient Penicillin Allergy Testing, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis, that article in and of itself found that basically for every time that you write penicillin allergy, it turns out that 95% of the time the patient is penicillin tolerant. But I digress, and I digress on to something that we also are not very good at giving, and that of course is vaccines. And not just any vaccine, but particularly the HPV vaccine. That takes me to an article in the Journal of American Prevention Medicine 2018, Cervical Cancer Incidence in Young U.S. Females After HPV Vaccine Introduction. Basically, here's what they were looking at. What's the incidence of cervical cancer? What's going on with the epidemiology, the surveillance, if you will? And here's what they found. The four-year average annual incident rates for cervical cancer in 2011 and 2014 were 29% lower than they were in 2003 to 2006. Now, that is a relative term, of course, and in absolute numbers, we're really only looking here at about 2.5 less cases out of a million people, but still, that's 2.5 cases, less cases of cervical cancer out of a million people. That's still 2.5 less cases for a relatively benign injection or vaccine. And now that we're down to only giving 2 vaccines, I mean, this should be much easier to complete than really about anything. We know that vaccines as a whole really don't do a whole lot. If you're looking for the flu vaccine to protect everyone, then you're going to be wrong because the flu vaccine doesn't protect everyone. If you're looking for the seatbelt to save everyone, Well, you're wrong, because again, the seatbelt doesn't really save everyone. In fact, for the overwhelming majority of individuals, the seatbelt does nothing. The flu vaccine does nothing. The leaving your house and evacuating during a hurricane probably does nothing for a large majority of individuals, because the hurricane veers off path. It goes a different way. It goes from a Category 5 to a Category 1. It's not a direct hit. You don't live on the water, but you don't really need it until you actually need it. You don't need to evacuate until it's too late. You don't need the vaccine until you already have the cancer. You don't need the seatbelt until you get in the car accident. This is something we should be doing, and this is just more proof that the cervical vaccine or the HPV vaccine works, as do all vaccines. Moving on with the literature, I recently have dug into insomnia. Insomnia is one of those magical things in life. It is like the sunshine and rain. You don't necessarily appreciate the sunshine unless you have the rain. You don't appreciate a good night's sleep until you've had a night of insomnia. Now, some of the interesting things, or at least real quickly, the interesting things that I find about insomnia is that we should probably, if we're going to give medication, we should probably give the smallest dose possible. The reason being, in the trials of the good stuff, oh yes, the good stuff, the real good stuff, the sleeping agents, the Lunesta, the Ambiens. Yes, I know, I'm not using the generic names, because even in medicine, I don't use the generic names for those, because besides for Zolpidem, they're kind of hard to pronounce. Now, anyways, in the trials on those, individuals who got the good stuff got about an extra 20 minutes of sleep compared to those that got placebo. Oh yes, 20 minutes of sleep, pretty awesome. But realistically, that's not even enough time to Netflix and chill. I mean, that is just not enough time. So if you're only getting 20 minutes different than placebo, we surely should not be giving high doses of this, just be giving low doses. Because as we know, the higher the dose, the higher the side effect. And again, that 20 minutes was based on objective data. They had you hooked up to sleep monitors and they could tell how long were you out for. But when they asked the patients subjectively about their sleep, there was a 7-minute difference. Oh yeah, patients who got placebo, patients who got the real good stuff, noted a 7-minute difference, or what they interpreted as a 7-minute difference between the two. Now again, that not only is not enough time to Netflix and chill, that's not enough time to even get the Netflix loaded, especially when you have really poor internet like I do. But insomnia is not a game changer. Insomnia is not going to make the world go round. It's not going to save us $1,000,000,000,000,000,000, but this next article might. It is from the Annals of Internal Medicine, titled 12-month outcome after transplant of hepatitis C infected kidneys into uninfected recipients, a single group trial. Yes, you heard it right from the title itself. You do not have Hep C. You are sitting in a chair getting dialysis. And then they come to you and they say, hey, listen, we're going to do this trial where we are going to give you a kidney. And you say, yippee, I get a kidney. However, then they tell you that kidney is going to come from an individual who has hepatitis C. Typically, years ago, even not that long ago at all, actually, this would have been a death wish. I mean, you're not going to take a kidney that is giving you Hep C, but the times are a-changing. Oh, the times are a-changing. This was a small study of only 20 patients, but you got to remember, 20 patients that didn't have Hep C that agreed to then get a Hep C kidney and then take antivirals immediately afterwards. Only 20 patients, but it was a 100% cure rate. That's amazing. I think that this is a game changer. And why do I think it's a game changer? Because in 2016, there were 800 kidneys from donors with hepatitis C virus that were discarded, thrown in the trash because we thought, well, this has no use. We can't use this Hep C kidney. Those are 800 patients that we could get off the transplant list. And there are projected more kidneys out there that we didn't even harvest because we just figured, well, we can't use them. This is big deal. This is big time. And I think this will change how we practice medicine in the future. And I think this moment right here, right now, September 2018, you should remember this moment because this is a time where the treatment for chronic kidney disease and the treatment for Hep C is changing and changing right in front of our eyes. And speaking of changing, how about when the skin changes from normal skin to abnormal skin? We like to call it cancer, and maybe it's cancer because of hydrochlorothiazide. That is from a paper titled Hydrochlorothiazide Use and Risk of Non-Melanoma Skin Cancer, a Nationwide Case Control Study from Denmark. This is in the Journal of American Academy of Dermatology back in April. And I'm not going to go too deep into this study, but basically here's what they found out. That if you were taking hydrochlorothiazide and you were taking it for a long time and your lifetime exposure had been pretty high, 50,000 milligrams, which is really high, but if you think about the average dose of hydrochlorothiazide at 25 milligrams, that basically means you're taking it for about 5.5 years. That in and of itself doesn't necessarily seem so bad, especially because guidelines say that this is one of our first line options. And if you have an African American population that doesn't respond well to ACE inhibitors, as we've talked about in previous episodes, then, you know, this is probably a good option. And you don't want to go with a calcium channel blocker or Norvasc because of the risk of the edema. I mean, this is really a decent option. In 5.5 years of taking the medication, really isn't that long. Now, the odds ratio, if you were taking over 50,000 milligrams, odds ratio 1.3 for basal cell carcinoma, almost 4 for a squamous cell. And then if you go to the highest cumulative dose during the study, what they looked at, which was over 200,000 milligrams. Again, this is taking the blood pressure medication for 20 years. That's a long time, but not unheard of. You had an odds ratio of 1.5 for basal cell and 7.3 for squamous cell. It's believed that this has to do with the photosensitivity of the drug. Again, I don't really want to talk too much about this. It is something to note. It's probably something to talk to your patients about. It's probably something that you should consider in your high-risk individuals, your gingers, your individuals that have family history of melanomas or basal cells or squamous cells. I mean, it's worth talking about. Now, if you have someone who tans really well, they don't have any family history of it all, they've never had a family history of it, you're not really worried about it, probably not that big of a deal. But an individual, a ginger that looks like myself, burns relatively easy in about 10 minutes in the Florida sun, this would probably be a good idea to avoid this drug. Are they going to necessarily get basal cell or squamous cell just because you gave them the drug? Probably not in the end. But if you want to be an A+ overall all-star doctor, this is something that should probably be in the back of your mind. Now moving on to the next article, and sometimes when the evidence starts to come in, it starts to pour in one after another. And of course, I am talking about an article in BMJ 2018, sulfonylureas as second-line drugs in type 2 diabetes and the risk of cardiovascular and hypoglycemic events, a population-based cohort study. This is basically saying that sulfonylureas are bad. Drugs are bad, cocaine is bad. Methamphetamines, bad. Sulfonylureas for your diabetics, probably not good, and maybe even bad. A follow-up of just over 1 year, sulfonylureas were associated with an increased risk of myocardial infarction at basically two more myocardial infarctions per 1,000 patients. That's one myocardial infarction per 500 patients. And had an increase in all-cause mortality, again, about 6 extra cases of all-cause mortality per 1,000 patients. And if that wasn't enough harm for you, they also had an increased risk in severe hypoglycemia, which shouldn't be surprising anyone, again, about 5 more per 1,000 patients, compared with metformin as monotherapy. So again, if you're giving sulfonylureas, especially as just monotherapy, you need to stop. You need to stop completely right now. Now, that again is with sulfonylureas as a monotherapy, but the thing that I found interesting in this study of almost 80,000 people in this population cohort based out of the UK was that when you added sulfonylureas to metformin, that huge risk seemed to decrease. In fact, the risk for myocardial infarction, the hazard ratio, almost reaches down to the line of 0 or 1, so no significant difference. And then the all-cause mortality does reach down to the line of no significant difference, down to 1. So I really do think that this says two things, and two things that we probably already know. Sulfonylureas, not good. Metformin, good. Add sulfonylureas to metformin, and likely the metformin is good enough that it kind of, you know, washes out the badness of sulfonylureas. But we don't totally know, and again, I understand the easy draw to them because they're cheap and they're wonderful, and you know, patients can afford them and pick them up, but it also stinks that the patients might die a little sooner or have heart attacks sooner. So maybe the best way that they can do this is walk 5 miles to the store, pick up their metformin, take the pill, and then walk 5 miles home. That way, they're getting true lifestyle interventions and metformin, and not metformin and sulfonylurea with no lifestyle interventions. And the reason I say walking to the store will probably help them is because they'll lose weight, and we know losing weight does wonders for type 2 diabetes. And of course, that was shown in the Annals of Internal Medicine, September 4th, a paper titled Microvascular Outcomes in Patients with Diabetes After Bariatric Surgery versus Usual Care, a MASH cohort study. Now, this study has been done over and over and over again, and it is just kind of shining through that bariatric surgery might be the answer. Whether we look at the complications, whether we're looking at just the weight loss, whether we're looking at the A1C and the surrogate market that it is, whether we're looking at the number of medications that they're on or are required to use, whether we're looking at the use of insulin to get their diabetes under control, when you look at bariatric surgery, it seems to do something magical with type 2 diabetes. And that quote-unquote magic is probably occurring for two reasons. They're eating less because they have to, and they're losing weight because they're likely eating less. Again, it's hopefully lifestyle changes like walking to the mall and back, but I'm not so optimistic because we don't have any evidence to suggest that. The only thing we do have is evidence that says they're eating less and they're losing weight. Now, in this study, bariatric surgery in diabetic patients compared with just usual intensive care in those that had the bariatric surgery had significant reductions in retinopathy, an absolute difference of 4%, neuropathy, an absolute difference of about 15%. And this was all over the course of 5 years. An improvement in microvascular complications over the course of 5 years doesn't really happen in any medication that we have. So this may be the big ticket. This might be it. Now it's time for the podcast when I talk about my feel-good segment. My feel-good segment that should make you feel good and then not feel so good about big pharma. And that, of course, is the FDA approved the first generic version of the EpiPen. I'm sure we all remember the big rush, the big craze, the big news story that came out that EpiPens were costing $300 and patients couldn't afford their EpiPens and they were dying of anaphylactic shock everywhere. Well, it wasn't quite that bad, but we get the point. And yes, it was a little ridiculous that the medication cost so much. Well, FDA approved the first generic EpiPen by Teva, T-E-V-A, Pharmaceuticals, and guess what? They're not telling us how much they're going to charge for it. So, hopefully it's less than $300, but right now their competition is at $300. So even if they put their EpiPen at $280, $250, it's still a bargain, which is a sad, sad day. I have one more article to talk about, and then a really feel-good little moment for you. A new guideline that I'm going to give you a brief update on. The one new article is from the Annals of Rheumatology Disorders 2018. It's a paper titled Intramuscular Glucocorticoid Injection versus Placebo Injection in Hip Osteoarthritis, a 12-week blinded randomized control trial. This study is a big deal. It's probably a game changer if anyone will listen to it, because the guidelines currently suggest that intra-articular steroid injections should be used for patients with hip osteoarthritis who have not responded to oral medications, but they don't really give a lot more details on that inside the guidelines. And while it is rare, septic arthritis is a real thing, and it happens. If you stick enough needles in enough hips, there is going to be one septic arthritis case out there that you likely cause. So in this new trial, in this study, the Dutch investigators gave intramuscular injections of glucocorticoid or placebo to 100 patients with hip osteoarthritis. And then they followed them up at 2, 4, 6, and 12 weeks after the injection. And then they said, you know, what's your severity on a 10-point scale? The mean difference in their change of pain while at rest or while walking was about 1 to 1.5 points on a 10-point scale. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait a second, that one on a 10-point scale, that's not very big over placebo. You are correct. It is not very big over placebo. But remember, these were just injections into the gluteus maximus, if you will. There, you had a nurse come in, pinch the butt, and give the injection, not with ultrasound or fluoroscopy or trying to get it right inside the joint capsule in the space on the ball. No, no, no. These are just, into the muscle, nothing big. And while that may not sound impressive, when you look at other studies that are done actually using fluoroscopy or ultrasound guidance, I mean, we're looking at 100 patients, 90 days, no difference in pain. These are small numbers when we look at the actual injections when they're getting it right in the spot. And so I know that this was not a head-to-head comparison of using fluoroscopy or using ultrasound guidance with just doing the IM injection, but the differences are about the same, if not even a little bit better for this IM injection. So we should definitely give consideration. And certainly if you have an individual who is morbidly obese and it's going to take you a huge needle to get in there and you're not sure if your ultrasound probe is going to be quite enough, this might be the patient that you can try it on. Or at least you should think about trying it on this patient. Now, that brings me to my last point. And I never want you to think that you're listening to Questioning Medicine without getting something out of it, without being on the advanced cutting edge of medicine, if you will. So, with that being said, here you go. The United States Preventative Services Task Force, they've come out with their new recommendations. Their new recommendations that say, hey, listen, HPV is good enough. Yes, they're still saying between the ages of 21 and 29 that we should do just cervical cytology. However, with the most recent article, I think we could probably bump HPV down to even age 25, which would be pretty nice. However, they do say in their newest recommendation here, every 5 years with high-risk HPV testing alone, or every 5 years with high-risk HPV testing in combination with cytology in women age 30 to 65. There's only one thing I want to say about that is, if you're going to do it with high-risk HPV by itself or high-risk HPV with cytology alone, and in both of them are 5 years, you're not gaining extra years. In fact, you're probably gaining harm just by looking at the studies and the false positives that come with it. Why on earth would you ever add cytology? Why would you add the extra cost? Why would you add the extra brush? Why would you add the extra time when HPV high risk is good enough by itself and it does the job good enough by itself, which I do believe you heard here first on Questioning Medicine. And so hopefully in the future, it'll just say high risk HPV, it's good enough. You don't need to do anything else. Don't even worry about cytology, at least not for the screening part. And that is all I got to say about that. Remember to keep your eyes open for Right on Prime. Right on Prime is the primary care part of MRAP that Joe and I are working hard, diligently, day and night to bring this new, awesome CME education, which you still get with the MRAP subscription. You get like, if you like Paper Chase, you're going to get like a uber duber mega doses of Paper Chase. I mean, you're going to get guidelines. You're going to get recommendations. You're going to get long pieces, short pieces, and you still get the MRAP piece, and you still get the core clinical content. I mean, it is all for a low, low price. They're basically giving away CME over there at MRAP, and we're just so happy to be part of it. So if you've got a few extra dollars sitting around, I'm not saying you should go get CME from MRAP, which is everything you could ever need. But I'm saying, And before I close, before I end it like I always end it, let's do a quick recap of everything we've talked about so far. First of all, antibiotics. If they say they're allergic to penicillin, you should probably double check them, because if you're not, then you are committing your patient to a lifelong increased risk of MRSA and C. diff. The HPV vaccine actually works, and we need to make sure that we're giving it to our patients. If you have insomnia or your patient has insomnia, yes, the medications do work for it, but they don't work probably as well as we think, probably only 20, 30 minutes extra sleep. So if you're going to give them a dose of it, give it to them low dose. There's only more harms at the higher doses. If you have chronic kidney disease, have no fear. There might be a solution coming near, and that is, of course, patients with Hep C. There is a huge plethora extra of these Hep C kidneys out there that we can now transplant because we have treatment for Hep C. This is game-changing. If you're considering giving your patient a blood pressure medication, well, if they're a ginger, they look like they're at high risk for skin cancer, you should probably consider not giving them hydrochlorothiazide. It's not a certain death wish, but if you want to be VIP top-notch dog doctor, then this is what you should consider doing or not doing. If you're treating a type 2 diabetic, well, then you need to consider treating them with something other than just sulfonylureas monotherapy. If you have to add it on because it's the only thing they can do, you better make sure that you're giving them metformin so that you probably wash out some of the harms of sulfonylurea. But again, we're just chasing a surrogate marker of an A1C. With that being said, lifestyle modifications are the best, or not consuming as many calories and losing weight, which leads us to bariatric surgery. Again and again, this is being shown as the top dog for losing weight and getting rid of that diagnosis that is type 2 diabetes. And now we even have a study that's showing that it decreases the complications of diabetes, which is what we really care about. There is a new generic EpiPen out, but we don't know how much you're going to charge for it because the drug company won't release that information. I'm sure the price point will be just right where it'll be less than the standard, but it'll still be a lot more than we should be paying. If you're going to do a hip injection for osteoarthritis, well, then you should consider doing just a gluteal injection, just an injection in the IM. Because when you look at the studies, although not head-to-head, this most recent trial shows that the reduction in pain is about the same compared to placebo. Septic arthritis is real, and sticking a needle down in there doesn't seem to necessarily get us that much bigger benefit. So consider an IM injection of steroids. And last but not least, there are new cervical cancer guidelines out there, and they say what we were saying years ago, and that is HPV every 5 years after the age of 30 is good enough. Don't need to do cytology because the risk or the cost only goes up without any added benefit. All right, that was your quick little summary. So until next time, I will end this podcast like I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.